Hey, constant listeners, this is the Far Middle Podcast, episode 48. Nick DeOlias with you. It is good to be with you. Who or what are we going to dedicate episode 48 to? Now, this being the Far Middle, you know we have a very extensive, deep research team to bring you just the best and most creative and most awe-inspiring data and knowledge that are out there. So for episode 48, we're going to dedicate the episode not to a player, like we typically do or usually do, but instead to a thing. We're going to dedicate 48 to the strikeout in baseball. Why, might you ask, are we doing that? Because the strikeout and number 48, they are intertwined, and you may not understand to the extent that those two things are intertwined. First, 48 is the record number of combined strikeouts in a single Major League Baseball game. The Yankees versus the Cubs in 2017, a couple years back, that's when it happened. It occurred at Wrigley Field. And if you do the math, you're going to find that 48 strikeouts, that's equivalent to 8 full innings of strikeouts. Full innings, not half innings for each team, but a full inning for both teams, 8 out of the 9 innings in a standard game. So in other words, both teams had on average just 3 outs that were not strikeouts for the entire game. But this is a little bit misleading because I got to tell you the rest of the story. You see, this game where there were 48 strikeouts, it went into extra innings. And just a couple of extra innings, I might add, it went actually to a total length of 18 innings in the game. So it was twice the normal or standard length of a baseball game. Thus, that's a big driver as to why there were 48 strikeouts across the full 18 innings. Now, if you didn't like that statistic and that record to link episode 48 to the strikeout, how about another one? Because 48 and the strikeout are intertwined a second way. And that's because another Major League Baseball record, this one being the most strikeouts by a pitcher in the first 4 starts of a season, that's 48 as well. Now, who holds that record? It's actually jointly shared, the record itself, by 2 people that you might have heard of. First is Nolan Ryan. He did it in 1978. And the second is a Cy Young Award winner himself, which is Shane Bieber of the Indians. He did it in 2021 or last year. So those two individuals logged 48 strikeouts in their first 4 season starts. So 48 and 4 starts, that's 12 per game, 4 times in a row. Wow. Now, while the strikeout is impressive, right, it sometimes comes with downside. It's sort of like Babe Ruth. When people talk about Babe Ruth, they say, yeah, on one side of the equation, he's got all those career home runs. But on the other side of the equation, what came with the home runs was also having all those career strikeouts. Same is true with respect to pitching and the strikeout. And you have to look no further than Nolan Ryan, who we were just talking about with his 48 record. Of course, he's the career strikeout king, and he's the career strikeout king by a very, very wide margin. Number 2 is a distant second. I believe it's Randy Johnson. And not only is he the career strikeout king, but he's also got a record 7 no-hitters. Of course, very impressive. But he also holds records for some other things in baseball. Career wild pitches, career for walks, and career for giving up stolen bases. All, again, by hugely wide margins like his strikeout record. That's risk-reward. Sometimes they travel as a pair, and that certainly is true for sports, that's true for baseball, and that is true for the strikeout. All right, now that we're off and running, let's start connecting some dots. So speaking of risk-reward, let's talk about investing in ESG, or environmental social governance investing. People sometimes believe, and perhaps naively, that because this is, you know, what they've been told and to a certain extent how it's been marketed, that investing in funds that aim to better the world, a la the E or the S or the G, they're also great ways to mitigate or reduce risk. Not necessarily. That's not always going to be the case. And in many instances, it's going to be downright wrong thinking. That's because doing right, sometimes that correlates to, that is code for amping up risk. Change is risky even when there are going to be rewards or perceived rewards of the change itself. So 2 of the biggest investment houses, not just on Wall Street, but in the world, recently delivered a nasty surprise for their investors in an emerging market bond fund that tracked an ESG index. That fund had exposure to both Russian and Ukrainian government bonds. Yes, Russia as in Putin bonds. And how, you know, Russia is ESG just or ESG friendly sort of defies logic at first blush, but there it was sitting in the portfolio. Then you had the war breakout with Ukraine. Sanctions came down, and guess what happened to Russian sovereign debt? As you might expect, it got hit, and thus the ESG fund took a hit relative to the overall market. Well, now, after the damage is done, these investment houses are announcing plans to remove Russia from the ESG index. I guess in some ways that gives new definition to a day late and a dollar short, or maybe a ruble short in this instance. If you want to change the world through ESG investing or ESG funds, I'd recommend you do a couple of things to do yourself a favor. First, make sure that how you define doing good is the same way that the fund manager and where she or he is investing your money is defining doing good. Those two things can be very different, that definition or those two definitions. I don't think most of these ESG index investors that we just spoke about thought that investing in Putin's debt was equating to doing good, but someone managing the fund defined it as such. Second, be ready to take on more risk. That would mean lower returns in investment parlance, because risk could also affect returns. So if you want to underwrite global progress with your pocketbook or your retirement savings, that's your right. You've obviously got the wherewithal to do so. Go right ahead, but do so with eyes wide open. Doing well by doing good, it sounds nice. It's something that, you know, everybody, including myself, wants to be part of. But feeling that and just not thinking it through, as an investor, you can get lulled into a bit of what I'd call an ESG coma. But in this instance, investors, right, with this this index fund that we just spoke about, they didn't do good with the negative returns, and they certainly weren't investing in right with Russian sovereign debt. Again, it's that risk-reward pairing. Buyer and investor beware, always. And if it holds for life and overall investing, it certainly should hold true for ESG investing. Now, speaking of Russia and Ukraine, I've been watching, like everybody else has, this unfolding tragedy and slaughter that's going on in that region of the world, aka that's what war is, and the crimes on humanity that typically go with it. And I'm somewhat of a military history student. I see something here, looking at this situation, has changed that most analysts and experts, they're not emphasizing or talking about this enough, at least from my perspective, when it comes to how modern war is being waged. And it really speaks to the issue of air power, what air power means, how you get air superiority on the modern day battlefield. Air superiority is not what it used to be, at least as we think of it, or we've been taught to think of it when it comes to World War II, or the experiences in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. Air power and air superiority, it's evolving. And this evolution is something that Russia is learning in a very painful way before our very eyes. And you can see this when you think through or just sort of consider a couple of different perspectives. First, going into the opening of the war, Russia had dominant air superiority at the start of hostilities. They had more airplanes, they had more helicopters, they had more advanced versions of both. But those advantages were quickly neutralized, and they never really manifested themselves into ground domination. Now, why was that? That begs the question why we didn't see that happen. It wasn't because of a no-fly zone that was implemented by the EU or NATO or the United States. We were all too timid to do that. And it wasn't because we sent Ukraine helicopters or jets. Again, we were too timid when it comes to the West's support of the Ukraine. Instead, I think it was because of two reasons. First, surface-to-air missiles that could be fired from mobile shooters made for havoc, absolute havoc on helicopters. Russia lost a lot of choppers and troops from these, and it negated a lot of the advantages of helicopters as offensive weapons against ground forces, as well as mobility advantages for moving troops and supplies around. So I think that was a big factor and continues to be so. Second, drones have allowed the Ukraine to field an effective substitute for an air force. Drones disrupted convoys, they disrupted supply lines. Many of you might have seen the videos of that. Drones basically made it unsafe for troops to mass or convene in the open, sort of took away the comfort of the Russian ground troops. And drones were able to negate the advantages an enemy looks for when it's flexing air superiority. And drones can deliver much of the offensive advantages of air power. It gets you something close to what you would have had with conventional air power in the form of manned planes and helicopters. So although this is maybe fortuitous for the Ukraine and their struggle, I think this has major implications far beyond Ukraine and Russia. The West And the United States enjoyed air superiority for decades when conducting military operations, and in many instances, air superiority was both a deterrent to avoid battle and a deciding factor during battle, so it was doubly effective. Perhaps we've been lulled into a bit of a false assumption of enjoying air superiority in the next conflict that flares up. I'm not so sure it'll be as easy as we think. I'm not so sure that the West or the United States will enjoy air superiority in future conflicts like they used to if we don't evolve our tactics, and if we don't evolve our technologies, and if we don't adopt and adapt our approaches with how we are conducting use of air forces. The Ukraine was able to do what it did, which was negating Russian air superiority with hand-me-downs, basically, with third-party equipment, and nothing else other than a desire to fight and resist. So what would a determined foe be able to do if they were self-armed against the West, like China or Iran or the like? Nothing stays static, including warfare. I just hope that our military leaders are watching this closely and subscribing to the view of evolve or die. So while Russia's out there committing these atrocities and warring, what is that beacon of leadership, global leadership, the United Nations doing? Well, what they're doing is what you might expect and what you might fear, unfortunately. Let's remember, the United Nations was created first and foremost to keep world peace. Russia invades Ukraine, and now here we are with the specter of World War III and nuclear escalation looming. A month after the war starts, the leader of the United Nations, the UN Secretary General, speaks of, quote, a climate catastrophe, end quote, and how fossil fuels will bring, quote, mutually assured destruction, end quote. That's a nuclear war term for those of you that aren't familiar with it, MAD, mutually assured destruction. We're now equating that to climate change. Wonder why the United Nations has become a laughingstock. If you're wondering why, there's a prime example right there in front of you. All the more ironic, by the way, as the president of the Ukraine, President Zelensky, addresses the Security Council days after this ridiculous statement from the Secretary General of the UN. And recall in the last episode of the Far Middle, we talked about how Pope Francis is obsessing and sort of singularly focused on climate change and climate change policies while he's evading any criticism of Russia and what it's doing with the Ukraine. Seems like the United Nations and the Vatican, they see things these days the same way. That's the climate change policies in the abstract 50 years from now. Those things are going to supersede things like the human condition today, murder, and the state of the planet today. By the way, the UN Security Council has permanent, of course, and rotating members on that Security Council. Countries like China, which is a permanent member of the Security Council, they can veto resolutions. Russia, by the way, is also a permanent member of the Security Council. Do you think for a minute that either one of these, both doing their own forms of what you'd consider human rights abuses, are going to support resolutions from the Security Council that back the Ukraine? Is someone famous, one of our leaders likes to say, come on, man. That's why, again, the United Nations has become a charade. And then on the topic of climate change and energy policies, which we've been talking about in recent episodes of the Far Middle, let's see what's going on while all this is occurring in the Ukraine with Europe's energy mix. There's the myth, which Europe gets its energy from renewables like wind and solar, and then there's the reality. The reality, 3% of EU energy comes from wind and solar. 3%. 70% of the EU's energy comes from fossil fuels. Lots of it, of course, unfortunately, coming from Russia, due in large part to climate change policies. Much of the balance between the 70 and the 3, right? So 3% from wind and solar, 70 from fossil fuels, that's 73%. Much of the balance to get to 100% is coming from gimmicks that the EU is employing, like hauling wood chips from the United States to burn in power plants in Europe. You add up the carbon footprint of that endeavor from transportation, how you get the wood chips, what's going on with the power plant, it's making CO2 net worse. Again, all stemming from climate change policies and the decisions made underneath them and the false warranting of entities like the United Nations when they keep pushing to make us believe the unbelievable. Now you see the reality that this political science that isn't based on science can have and some of the catastrophic consequences that are going to stem from it. First being, of course, what's going on in Ukraine. Second being what's happening with respect to energy scarcity, energy reliability or lack thereof, and energy cost and inflation generally across all of Europe. Now, United Nations thinks mutually assured destruction, MAD, is from things like domestic natural gas in the United States and not from Russia and nukes. Here at home, we're suffering from our own version of a very disturbing form of self-induced MAD. And the weapon is violence in our major cities. Now, there are unfortunately many, many examples to choose from, and that's obviously a saddening thing, but let's focus in on one city that's always front and center and just an iconic, awesome city. I'm speaking of Chicago, of course, the Windy City. Chicago continues to spiral out of control with violent crime. It's heartbreaking, and it's particularly heartbreaking for the young, but generally, really for everybody these days that is in a collateral damage zone of fire. Murders, if you just look at that, they're up 55% in 2020 versus 2019. 2021 murders, they broke 800 people in Chicago. Chicago reports a 53% clearing or solving rate for murders. So if you look at the Chicago Police Department and you take a look at the 800 murders in 21 or whatever the striking increases were, the 55% increase in 19 versus 20, year on year. Across those murders, the police department says about half, 53%, are going to be cleared or solved. But if you look at the statistics a level lower, if you peel that onion away one more layer, that 53% clearing or solving rate, that underneath it has an assumption that 6 in 10 of those clearings are of the, what's designated, I'm quoting here, the cleared, closed exceptionally, end quote, variety. Now, what does cleared, closed exceptionally mean? It means the murder was determined to be solved, but there were no charges filed due to poor evidence. That smells. That makes me really wonder if we're even seeing a 53% clearing solving rate for homicides in Chicago. I suspect in reality it's way, way lower than that. There's another phenomenon that is very disturbing in Chicago, which are shootings and killings on the expressway, on basically the interstate highways in and around the city itself. That's the new threat. It's taking fights or beefs to things like the Dan Ryan Expressway, which is a major highway in Chicago. Shootings on the expressway increased fivefold in two short years. In 2 years' time, you saw a 500% increase in expressway shootings. And the killings here on the expressway, those murders, they don't count towards the city murder count. Why? Because of bureaucracy. The expressway is managed by the state, not the city. So under the bureaucratic rules, they're not counted as city homicides, even though we all know and we all recognize that they indeed are. It just shows you the bureaucracy. It never sleeps, even during the most severe, right, and serious of crises that are out there. Now, carjackings, it's another problem when it comes to violent crime in Chicago. They're up 200% in 2 years' time. So expressway shootings are up 500%. Carjackings are up 200%, both in 2 years' time. Police make arrests for only, you'll be surprised by this, but it's true, only 11% of carjacking incidents. So for 1 out of 10 carjackings, give or take, that's when an arrest will be made. The other 9 out of 10 carjackings, no arrests. And the state attorney in Chicago proceeds with felony charges in those 11% of arrest cases only half the time. So think this through. For carjackings, 1 out of 10 will result in an arrest. 9 out of 10 will go without arrest. And of the one where it does result in arrest, only about half are going to be actually charged. So that means basically 1 out of 20 are ultimately going to face charges for a carjacking. Do you think that might be part of the problem here? A lack of consequence. I've always been partial to Chicago. It's always been a favorite city of mine. I sort of view it as like a big brother to Pittsburgh, where I am from. But I do worry for the future of Chicago these days. And Chicago being such an iconic city, as Chicago goes, ladies and gentlemen, so goes our nation to a very large extent. For sure, Chicago's crime statistics, there are a lot of things. They're sobering, they're saddening, they're disturbing, all of the above. And it really speaks to erosion of a basic societal need. In this instance, of course, it's that of public safety, which brings me to sort of the next thought or dot. There is another basic societal need that's eroding before our very eyes due to poor policy, and that is electric grid reliability and the assumption of having power when you want it or you need it. Now, most people would not think of that as a basic societal need because we've been spoiled. But I can assure you, and unfortunately, I think we're going to learn this lesson in reality, that it is very much a basic societal need. You lose that, you basically lose everything along with it. Came across a statistic on grid reliability here in the United States that was, frankly, shocking to me. And here's the stats. 20 years ago, less than 0.6% of U.S. homes over $150,000 in value had a backup generator, 0.6%. So basically, nobody had backup generators. Today, so you fast forward from 20 years ago to today, 5.75% of those homes have a backup generator. That's a tenfold increase, or nearly a tenfold increase. Sad state of affairs when homeowners realize that the American grid integrity is worse than 20 years ago. And do you think that climate change policies had anything to do with this? Or is it just coincidence that when those started to appear on the scene and manifest themselves in tangible decisions, you just saw a tenfold increase basically in backup generators in U.S. households? Or maybe it's as if the homeowners across this nation have figured out what the public utility commissions and utilities in places like California couldn't figure out before things like the Pacific Gas and Electric fiasco and disasters that went with it. It's about that time. And that means we're coming down the home stretch of episode 48 of The Far Middle. I hope you enjoyed this one. I did. This week, I want to conclude talking about what this week marks the anniversary of, and that is the Great San Francisco Earthquake of 1906. The earthquake itself only lasted for about a minute, give or take, but it killed 3,000 people, and then half the city ended up homeless within a matter of days because of all the fires that ravaged the city. If the structure wasn't made out of steel, basically it burned to the ground. So it basically, the fires after the earthquake destroyed the entire city. Only those steel structures survived. The most notable one, if you're familiar with San Francisco, is the Fairmont Hotel that sits up on Nob Hill. That was a stone and brick and steel structure. There's a lot of famous photos that just shows the devastation of the city. And then up on that hill, on Nob Hill, you can see the Fairmont still standing, and it stands to this day. So for those of you familiar with San Francisco, that's a very historic building for a couple reasons, one being it survived the quake. But sometimes, and this is why I wanted to bring up the subject of the 1906 San Francisco quake, sometimes the most pressing of tragedies, they do provide for silver linings. And that was true of what happened in San Francisco in 1906. The person who made it all possible, the silver lining that is, was an Italian-American by the name of Amedeo Peter Giannini. Now, he grew up in Northern California, so he's first-generation American, and he made his original fortune, and he was very successful, in the produce business. He ended up marrying a daughter of a San Francisco real estate magnate in the Italian North Beach area of San Francisco, and he ended up being able to retire at age 31, so at a really young age, after he sold his produce company to his employees. And at 31, after he sold out, was basically independently wealthy, he planned to enjoy life and look after his family and his in-laws' estates. Sounds like a pretty good game plan for those that are successful at that age to be able to do so. Now, when he was semi-retired, he sat on a local bank as a director that his father-in-law held an investment stake in or an interest in. And when he was on the local bank board as a director, he saw that the bank was unwilling, wouldn't lend to immigrants. And that really frustrated him. He thought that that was wrong. So he ended up leaving the bank, stepped down from being a director, and he decided to start his own bank. He says, I know what we can do. I'll do this the right way. I'll start my own bank. And that bank was originally named Bank of Italy. It started in 1903, a few years before the great quake of 1906. And its first home, the headquarters, so to speak, was a converted saloon. And the bank was dubbed to be one for what he referenced as the little fellow, sort of the common person, the common individual. And the bank happily lent to immigrants, and its deposits started to really grow, grew exponentially in a really short period of time. So it was a very successful business model. Then 1906, the earthquake hit San Francisco. And immediately after the earthquake, but before the approaching fires burned the city, Giannini moved the vault's money in the bank to his home outside the fire zone, what was then in rural San Mateo, not so rural these days, but back in 1906, it was rural, which is about 18 miles away, just under 20 miles away from downtown San Francisco. And he used a garbage wagon to haul the money around, literally a garbage wagon. He hid the money underneath the garbage. So he used the garbage to camouflage what was underneath it. And what happened here, and why it was an opportunity for Giannini and the Bank of Italy, the fires had raged for so long that they heated the vaults of all the other big banks so that people couldn't, the bank managers and employees couldn't access the vaults. They were basically, you know, superheated, hot. So the sudden temperature change, right, from opening them, it risked destroying the contents of what was inside. It just took a tremendous, you know, long period of time for the temperatures to normalize after it had been heated for that long. And many vaults were kept closed for weeks. So you basically had literally a shuttering of the financial system of capital markets in San Francisco because nobody could access their deposits except for Giannini. So during this period, Giannini was one of the few bankers who could satisfy withdrawal requests and provide loans at the same time. And he operated from a plank across two barrels in the street. His desk basically was set up in the street, which was devastated. He got two barrels, put a plank across it, and that was his desk where he went up to talk to him to get a loan or try to withdraw money that you had in his bank. Giannini, during this time, he made loans on a handshake to those that were interested in rebuilding their businesses or their homes. Years later, he would recount that every loan that he made during that earthquake sort of aftermath was repaid, every single loan. And as a reward to the garbage man, whose wagon that he used to move the money around to his new sort of bank branch of two barrels and a plank, Giannini gave the man's son his first job when he turned 14. So he knew how to return a favor. So the Bank of Italy, as a result of the crisis created from the great earthquake of 1906 in San Francisco, the Bank of Italy was off and running. And it really took off in another way when it perfected something that was new on the scene at the time. That was the branch bank model. Giannini saw the value of that, the efficacy of it early on. That helped Bank of Italy grow. And soon it needed to grow outside of San Francisco. It became a victim of its own success, needed to look for the next way to step up its growth plateaus. And it ended up merging, like a lot of businesses do, with a Los Angeles-based bank. That bank at the time was known as Bank of America. This merger happened in the 1920s. So this was about 15 years or so after the great earthquake. And after the merger, Giannini decided to adopt the Bank of America name for the merged entity. He ran it as chairman of the bank until the mid-1940s, toward the end of World War II. And he also owned, through those years, Transamerica Corporation. It was sort of the holding company for him, of which his different financial interests sat under, which the famous San Francisco skyscraper those of you who are familiar with San Francisco, the one that comes to a point with the interesting architectural design, was named after. So Bank of America just went off to do amazing things with respect to American industry. It was the funder, effectively, of the movie industry in California and also the wine industry in California. So two of the state's biggest industries that it's noted for that all of us get to enjoy from time to time. He lent to an individual. The guy's name at the time was Walt Disney. Maybe you've heard of him. And he lent him money to film a movie that you might have heard of. It was sort of a revolutionary type of a movie in terms of the technology. It was called Snow White. That was Bank of America. That was Giannini. And he also helped the financing to build that was needed to build the Golden Gate Bridge. And he also helped to build and grow Kaiser Industries, which was a huge industrial complex in California in the western United States that basically was one of the key backbone instruments of all of the manufacturing weaponry that was created to win and prevail in World War II. So Amedeo Giannini, first generation American, typical man doing atypical great things. Few today probably know or realize who he was, but a lot of people today enjoy the things that he built and that he created. That's America. That's free enterprise. That's capitalism and individual rights at work. Do you think AOC or Senators Warren or Sanders would ever allow a Giannini to achieve what he did then today? I fear that they wouldn't. Hey, this country isn't perfect, ladies and gentlemen. Far from it, but it is the greatest on earth. There's no doubt about that. Let's not blow it. Talk soon.